Hey, I'm Jo Lauder and you're listening to The Hack Podcast. Now, you might have heard the news that apparently Russia has a COVID-19 vaccine and they're going to start mass immunization in October. Apparently, Putin's daughter has even already had the jab and Putin says it's safe. But a lot of people are worried that they might be rushing it or Russian it, as a lot of people you'll hear make the joke. So we speak to a microbiologist who's closely involved with what's going on with vaccines here in Australia to find out what's going on, when the world will get back to normal with a vaccine, and if we should trust this one. Plus, we also have a fascinating conversation about these vaults in the Arctic that are set deep into the ice, and they're meant to preserve a bit of humanity's knowledge and information for future generations. So stick around for that one.
National Cabinet has been briefed on the progress being made on a number of potential vaccines around the
Vladimir
world.
Vladimir Putin said the vaccine was effective and safe and that even his daughter had received an inoculation.
Any country that would have found this vaccine and not make it available around the world, I think would be judged terribly by history.
On Triple J.
Yeah, it's just like the Cold War all over again, only this time Russia's apparently winning the race for a COVID vaccine. The Russian President Vladimir Putin says they've approved one and they're going to start widespread vaccinations in October. But a lot of people are worried that it's being rushed and they say that Russia might be cutting corners. Now, if you're like me and you can't wait for the world to get back to normal, which apparently is not going to happen until we get this vaccine, you've probably been watching all this news really closely. Well, Dr. Larissa Labson is a researcher at the University of Queensland, and she studies how our immune system detects and responds to viruses. And she's here to tell us a bit more about this. Thanks for coming on Hack, Dr. Labson.
You're welcome.
Now, Russia has come out today and said that it's got a vaccine, and apparently even Putin's daughter has had it. How should we be feeling about this?
Look, I think we should be feeling pretty cautious about this. I'm as hopeful as the next person that we're going to have a successful vaccine. And I certainly hope that this Russian vaccine is definitely safe and effective, but we don't have any data to support that yet. So we haven't seen any preclinical data, so any efficacy in animal studies. And that's something that we like to see for all vaccines before they go into human trials. And we haven't seen the results of the phase 1 clinical trials, which is where you give people the vaccine to try and work out what kind of dose you might need to give them and to make sure there aren't any adverse effects associated with giving the vaccine alone. And then it goes into phase 2 clinical trials, which is where it's a small subset of people are given the vaccine and then basically let loose into the community, I would say, and people are tested for whether they're protected against catching the virus. And once that's been passed, then people like to go into phase 3 trials, which is where really huge cohorts, so up to 30,000 people are being given the vaccine. And basically you're testing over an amount of time how protected they are from getting the virus altogether. So we're measuring efficacy. And all that we've heard from this Russian vaccine is that it definitely induces an immune response, so in terms of antibodies. So that is a good sign, but we have no idea what kind of immune response that looks like, how that compares with other vaccines, and how long that might last.
Yeah. Would you be confident that there's been enough time to even go through that whole process, given that this pandemic, like we really, I'm sure a lot of focus only really came on it at the beginning of the year, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So for long-lasting studies, there's just no way we can do it yet because it hasn't been around yet. So we can't say how long we're going to be protected from reinfection from the virus, even natural infection. We can't say how long a vaccine's going to last for because we'll only know that retrospectively.
Do you think Russia should show their working here? Like you were saying, we haven't seen any of the data. Should they release the research around it, or is there some kind of precedent for that?
As a scientist, we really like our science to be robust and transparent. And the only way we believe data is if we actually see the experiments and see the results. And so having someone just claim something without seeing anything, you know, it puts you a bit on the back foot. Science should be separated from the politics as much as possible. And again, it's not really a race to find the quickest vaccine. It's a goal to save people's lives.
Right. So with COVID-19, do you think, is there going to likely be, we might result in having more than one kind of vaccine that will be like operating throughout the community, or will everyone agree on one?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I do think we're going to have a load of different vaccines. Certainly it's a vaccine race at the moment, but what I think we'll find is that those that are quickest won't necessarily be the ones that are the best. a lot of these new technologies are pretty untested. We don't have any vaccines against coronaviruses yet, so there's still a lot we don't know. So it could be that one type of vaccine technology gives us a much better response than the others, and really only time will tell.
You're listening to Hack with me, Jo Lauder, and I'm joined by Dr. Larissa Labson, and she's from the University of Queensland, and we're chatting all things coronavirus vaccines. What about here in Australia? Where's the team at UQ at with their vaccine?
The team here at UQ, they're up to the phase one trial. So that's where they're testing the dose of the vaccine that they can put into people and whether it gives the expected immune response that it would. So what they'll do is they'll measure the amount of antibodies in people who've been given that test vaccine to see if it is doing what it should be doing. And so what they'll do is they'll test, like, how much can we give people? Because, you know, to go from a hamster to a person is quite a jump. And they make sure that there aren't any adverse effects in giving it to people straight off the bat.
And say another country gets there first, and maybe it is Russia, they'll prioritise their own citizens, obviously, getting the vaccine. But is there then some kind of process for how other countries and other citizens get it?
Yeah, that's something that I can't really comment on. I think that's then a negotiation between different governments, and there will be agreements to license the vaccines. And again, that, you know, is something that could come down to foreign negotiations and foreign policy and how you negotiate those kind of those questions, along with many other implications that this pandemic has had. So trade deals and border openings and closings, movement of people. And I think that the vaccine negotiations are going to be another part of that.
And also, I imagine there's going to be a lot of countries, especially developing countries, that don't have the capacity to develop their own. So is there going to be some process, would you imagine, for getting it out to those countries as well?
Absolutely. And I think that's something that the World Health Organization will be directly involved in. So the WHO has a huge role to play in this pandemic and ensuring that developing countries get access to any developed vaccines is going to be one of those major priorities, because as this pandemic has really shown, that if there's an outbreak anywhere, it can really, really spread very quickly all over the world.
Yeah, and we've been told the world won't go back to normal until there's a vaccine. As we were talking about before, there is a pretty decent anti-vax movement going on, and it's not just here in Australia, but around the world. Will vaccines be redundant or not effective enough if enough people don't opt to get it? And is there some kind of magic number that you have to hit for them to be effective?
That's a great question. So we certainly talk about herd immunity, and we've talked about that a lot when it comes to the measles vaccine. So you need a certain proportion of people to be vaccinated so that we protect any people who can't be vaccinated. So immunocompromised people, for instance, from catching the virus, because essentially what you want to do is you want to limit the opportunity for the virus to replicate and to transmit from person to person. We don't know yet what kind of number that would look like for coronavirus. And we also don't know yet if that's going to be totally achievable. So we have a couple of options with the vaccine for what's going to happen. The kind of immunity that a vaccine might elicit could be that sterilizing immunity. And that's kind of what we want for herd immunity. So that means that the vaccine won't really be able to infect you and establish an infection. So you won't be able to transmit it onto someone else. But what the vaccines might be able to do is to really reduce the severity of disease if you do get infected. You might still be able to transmit it to someone else, but instead of becoming severely ill with COVID-19, it might only feel like a mild cold.
Larissa, it's absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on Hack and explaining a bit more about it for us.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's Dr. Larissa Labson, and she's a researcher at the University of Queensland. On the text line, someone says, are they Russian, the vaccine? And apparently that joke is so good because we've got another version. Someone says, why did the scientists release a vaccine before completing a comprehensive testing? Because they were Russian. And Mortimer in Cranbourne North says, surely scientists are the one people, group of people we can trust, regardless of politics, race or creed.
We need to take a much more precautionary approach until we can find the source of this case and make sure that we reduce the risk of wider spread.
On Triple J.
Over the last couple of months, everyone in the world's been wishing they were from New Zealand. It's like the Lord of the Rings movies all over again. Seriously though, New Zealand had 102 days without any community transmission of COVID-19. They went early and they went hard on their lockdown, and they came out of the other side pretty fast. So I'm sure when everyone read the news last night that there's been 4 cases of COVID-19 in New Zealand, everyone was just like, what the hell has happened here? To find out a bit more about it, I've got Dr. Susie Wiles here, and she's an associate professor in microbiology at the University of Auckland, and she's also an advisor to the New Zealand government on its pandemic plan. Thanks for jumping on to chat, Dr. Wiles.
Oh, my pleasure.
Just to start with, how is everybody feeling about this news?
I think everybody's pretty shaken up. So we've been warning people for a while now that, you know, not to get complacent and that, you know, it's only a matter of time before we, you know, potentially get a case. But it came, I think the announcement late at night and then to be told the next day you're moving into restrictions really, I think, has frightened some people, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And we'll get a bit more into the lockdown soon. But do we know much yet about, this is a family of 4, right? Do we know much yet about how they potentially have got it or much anything at all about their cases?
No. So that's all a mystery at the moment. So yes, it's 4 people within a family who've all tested positive. And at the moment, there doesn't appear to be any link to overseas travel or to anybody who works in managed isolation or quarantine or at the border. So that's why it's being labelled as community transmission, and that's why we're going really hard and really fast to see if we can ensure there's no further transmission. So a huge amount of work is now going on, including sequencing the genomes to try and find out where these people got the virus.
Yeah, and I heard some reports, and they're obviously quite early reports, but this family might have worked around freight. Do we know if that's true, and would that change things?
Yeah, so one family member, I believe, worked at a business that deals with kind of cold storage, goods coming in through cold storage. And actually just yesterday there was a report from China of I think frozen seafood testing positive, and a whole group of people who work in that business are now in quarantine. So there have been some cases overseas where the possible source was something to do with frozen goods. And so that workplace has now been swabbed, and we'll see if anything pops up there as positive.
So the virus would potentially last longer in those conditions and therefore be transported to New Zealand. Is that what could have happened?
That's one working hypothesis. There's quite a few at the moment, and they're all being looked at, which is really good. So they're not ruling anything out yet. It's all come a bit quickly, so I haven't had chance to go and have a look and see really how much we know about this. I mean, we certainly know that the vast majority of transmission is human to human. But obviously, in a country like New Zealand that was doing a really good job controlling it, you know, we have to look at every option of how it might have come in again.
Yeah, another explanation, obviously, like you said, it's super early days, but one theory that people were chucking around is that there could have been undetected cases in New Zealand all this time. Is that possible or very likely at all?
I don't think that's very likely, because we know that, you know, a certain number of people will have a really hard time of this virus, and we still have been testing people with symptoms. So I would have thought if this was circulating around for a while, we would have seen it. We would have seen somebody come forward and test positive. And we haven't had that. We haven't had people in hospital with respiratory symptoms that have had COVID-19. So I think that's probably one of the most unlikely at the moment, but huge amounts of testing is going on now in the community. That's been completely ramped up, so we'll soon find out whether that's true or not.
Yeah, is there the race at the moment to do all the contact tracing and try and contain it?
Yes. So, well, it's not just containment, it's also this looking back. So where, you know, where did it come from? So there's all the contact tracing has been massively ramped up again, because that's all been, you know, those people have just been sort of on hold. But the more important thing, I guess, is the restrictions that we're now being put under around the country. And that really is to, you know, to try and limit any transmission that might happen.
How long are those restrictions for as well?
So at the moment, Auckland has moved to level three restrictions until Friday. So level three restrictions here are sort of equivalent to what Melbourne's under at the moment. And then the rest of the country is at level two, which means that so masking has been brought in, sort of the physical distancing and just being sort of more cautious. Auckland is pretty restricted. So it's not as restricted as our previous lockdown. And this is really just to sort of limit our movements for the next few days while they try and, gather some more information. I imagine on Friday we will probably be staying in some kind of restriction for a bit longer.
We've just got a text from Ben in Wollongong, and he says, the New Zealand example just proves that eradication does not work. Suppression until there's a vaccine, if there's a vaccine, is the only way forward. Keep distancing and washing hands, but going in and out of lockdown is stupid and dangerous. Dr. Wiles, what do you think about that point?
I just don't agree with that at all. I mean, it's the being able to move in and out means that when we're out, when everything's going well, we have very little response on us and very little no spread in the community. So I don't agree with that, and what we'll find out this time round is how quickly can we stamp it out and move back down the levels again.
Yeah, definitely. Well, once again, it's really great to get your insights. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
That's Dr. Susie Wiles, and she's an associate professor in microbiology at the University of Auckland.
Hack. I only actually had a small window to find this out, or I would have actually lost about 10 grand.
On Triple J.
So up until last week, I had absolutely no idea how much money I had in my super account, and I think a lot of you are probably in the same boat. So you probably wouldn't notice if some of it went missing. Well, to help with the hit from the coronavirus pandemic, the government allowed some people to dip into their super, and it's called the Early Release Superannuation Payment Scheme, and it's been really popular. But as Shalila Medora finds out, the corporate watchdogs warned that the scheme could be the target of a massive organised crime racket.
I actually got a text from the ATO last week letting me know that someone had accessed my account the day before and made some changes. And if it wasn't me, then I should give him a call.
Nat wasn't too worried when her phone pinged with that message from the tax office.
You get so many verification messages on your phone every day. You tend to just, sometimes they're a bit glitchy, and I tend to not necessarily take them all seriously.
She was kind of busy and briefly considered just ignoring it. Thankfully, she didn't.
My contact details had been changed. Then someone had actually put in an application for early release of super through the coronavirus scheme.
The early release scheme is the one the federal government announced to let people who are experiencing financial hardship as a result of the pandemic to access up to 20 grand of their super over two financial years.
I only actually had a small window to find this out, or I would have actually lost about 10 grand.
It's a good thing Nat called the ATO, because like a lot of young people, she doesn't really keep an eye on her superannuation.
I didn't even really know how much was in my super account before, so I would barely have noticed if it had changed.
Nat rang her super company to make sure everything was okay there too.
Someone had contacted them the day before and they had enough of my personal details that they could get into my account and change my details. So the super company didn't suspect anything. They'd made some changes to my account.
That's when she realised this scam was a whole lot bigger than she'd previously thought.
The way that this person managed this was to use the National Relay Service, which is kind of a service that's available for people that might have a disability, like a hearing impairment, and got someone to sort of speak on my behalf to access my account.
The ATO and Nat's super company sprung into action before any more changes could be made, and her money is now safe. But this isn't a one-off. Last week, three women were arrested on charges of fraud.
Officers say the group submitted several fraudulent applications claiming to be the superannuation fund holder in an attempt to access early release payments.
And today, the revelation that this thing could have far deeper roots.
The corporate regulator, ASIC, says it's received reports about a range of concerns, including serious and organised criminals trying to target the program.
It's no surprise, given almost $30 billion has been put out to people's bank accounts in early release super, that there will be criminals out there who want to target the money
Glenn McRae is the Deputy CEO of the Peak Body for the Industry, the Association of Superfunds Australia. His group raised concerns about fraud back in March when this scheme was being designed.
The key concern for us was we needed to get the money out safely.
The whole program was devised in less than 3 weeks, and Glenn acknowledges it could have had more safety built into it.
If we had our time again, I'm sure there is more we could do.
But he says that has to be balanced with making sure people could get their cash when they needed it.
I think if you had a bit more time, we probably could have designed it. But at that time in March, if you remember, it seemed like the world was falling in, and there needed to be, the government obviously took the view that money needed to get out to the economy and to people who needed it really quickly.
So many people have applied for early release of super and have done so successfully, and the rate of fraudulent behaviour is pretty low.
Assistant Commissioner at the Tax Office, Sonia Corsini, said there are red flags young people can keep an eye out for.
Things like, you know, your tax file number, your full name, your date of birth, things like that are really sensitive, so stay alert. The ATO won't ask you for those things in an email or an SMS.
She also reminded us that the early release scheme is free. So if you get people telling you to pay for a service in order to access it, it's definitely a scam.
The ATO never projects our number onto caller ID. So if there's a number on their caller ID that's coming from the ATO, it's not the ATO calling. And we're not going to threaten you with immediate arrest or jail or deportation or anything like that. So if you get a call like that or a voicemail, it's not coming from the ATO.
Most importantly, if you think your accounts have been compromised, call as soon as you can.
If you think you've fallen victim to a scam, call us as soon as you can on that number, 1-800-008-540.
Hack. Triple J.
That was Assistant Commissioner of the ATO, Sonia Corsini, ending that report by Shalila Medora. And if you need that number, again, it's 1-800-008-540. You're listening to Hack. I'm Jo Lauder. And right now, we're going to go to the top of the world.
Hack.
Deep in the Arctic Circle, this is where we will protect open source software for future generations. In the GitHub Arctic Code Vault.
On Triple J.
Yeah, in the most far north town in the whole world, there's obviously lots of snow, there's heaps of polar bears apparently, but there's also a bunch of growing archives filled with the information that we want to save for future generations, and it's deep in the ice. They're kind of like, if you think of it, like humanity's time capsules. And you might have heard also of the Seed Vault, and it's got over a million seed varieties in case we're ever going to need it. But there's now also the GitHub Source Code Vault. A few weeks back, 186 films were stored into this vault, and they've got the world's open source code printed onto them. And apparently it's going to last for 1,000 years. And look, there's so many things to untangle here about what information gets preserved, how we're going about this, why humanity's doing this. But before we get into it, this is kind of all about time capsules, and it got us thinking at the Hack team about the ones that we did at school as a kid. And we want to know if you did one, and if you put anything, I don't know, funny or hilarious into it, give us a call on 1300 055 536, or you can text on 0439 75 7555. Now, I'm also joined by futurist Mark Pesci. Hey, Mark.
Hi there.
Now, Mark, this all sounds really cool, this idea of the GitHub Source Vault. The code's written, though, on these reels that can only be read by a computer or by someone with a microscope. Great idea, but are we going about this the right way?
Well, if we're trying to preserve this against some sort of crash where basically we lose all of our technology and we end up living in caves again and we discover this cache, and we don't have any of the tools to use it, then we will have this effectively indecipherable object, this amazing object that we just don't understand enough to use. And so there's this question about how do you bootstrap? And we saw this happen on the Pioneer spacecraft. There was, the Voyager spacecraft. There was a record album that they put on it, which had images which were meant to be understood by someone who had no idea what a human being was and all of the necessary information to be able to decode it. So we need to be able to think about going into the far future to talk to people who know nothing about us, understand nothing about us, and make what we do clear to them.
And I mean, even closer to home, there's really good examples of where, I mean, like even just in people's garages and basements, there's probably, you know, like VHSs, CDs, stuff becomes obsolete really quickly, right?
It does. And most of the computer programs that were written, say, in the 50s and 60s, there isn't a single computer around that would run those programs anymore. You get into the 70s and 80s, maybe some of them. There were a lot of Nintendos around. So if you have an old Nintendo cartridge, you can either find an emulator for it or find a Nintendo to run it on. But if you have some obscure program that was written on a weird computer, you're out of luck. There aren't going to be any copies of that. Even if you have the program, you don't have the computer to run it on.
And this is about preserving, well, I guess the question is, why are we doing this? Like, is it about preserving information for future historians or archaeologists so they can dig it up whenever into the future? Or is it the concern that you were saying that we might completely accidentally wipe out all our information and have to start again?
So one of the big things that's actually being stored in this Arctic vault is the Linux operating system, the open source operating system that basically powers most of the smartphones, certainly all the Android smartphones on the planet, are based on Linux. And so in some ways, getting a copy of that and putting that aside is an insurance policy that someday, if we lose everything, we might be able to at least bootstrap enough that we can see what was on everyone's smartphones.
And then this isn't the only example. We were just talking then about there was the, near this is the seed vault as well, which is, I guess, another example. But one that I was reading about is a deep salt mine in Austria where apparently they're using ceramic tablets. They've been written on in laser and they're being stored there for future generations. It's called the Memory of Mankind, which I think is very, you know, it's quite romantic, I think, but a bit more than GitHub source vault. There's also the Long Now one. This might be a pretty basic question, but if we've got all of these around the place, are we doing anything to make sure people know where to look for them?
Well, this is one of the big jobs of the Long Now Foundation. They're trying to build a clock that will last for 10,000 years. So that's an engineering task, but it's also about how do you make a clock that's readable? How do you build a sign that tells someone 10,000 years from now that we buried a whole bunch of radioactive garbage in their neighborhood and they shouldn't go digging? This is why it's really actually important beyond the vaults to ask these questions, because we do sometimes have to pass the ball to a generation who will have no knowledge of us. And we still have to be able to tell them why they need to be careful.
We've got a great text here. Someone says, we actually opened our time capsule that we buried in the year 2000 last week. I was clearly a tad optimistic in regards to the flying cars. Oh, I'm so sorry. Greg in Wagga also says that he used to make time capsules in primary school and they put in photos, newspapers, letters, special toys, etc. Oh, I love hearing these stories. I put in one, I think it was a really embarrassing letter about the boy I had a crush on in year five. So I'll put it out there. But Mark, you just mentioned there before about the radioactive waste and stuff like that. This isn't just about information, right? There are people working on how we can communicate where we store nuclear waste as well, right? Because that's going to be around for a really long time.
Right, exactly. When you're talking about things that may be dangerous for tens or hundreds of thousands of years, then you really do have to figure out what's going to last that long. You know, a lot of rock will even wear away. If you inscribe something on rock after 10,000 years, you take a look at the oldest drawings we have out in the Kimberleys. Those are 50,000 years old, and some of them are just barely visible because they've been worn away by the natural processes. So in some ways, you have to think about that, and then you have to think about, well, what do those people know that we can tell them, what's recognizable to them?
Yeah, and just, I guess there's another question going back to the more like archaeological, historical ones. Is there an issue here with who gets to decide what information is preserved and what history we're passing on and whose kinds of stories are being passed on?
Particularly, I think, with the memory of man, which it is romantic, but you remember that it's a curation task. And this is a task that all librarians face as well. It's like, what do we save? What tells future generations the true story about us? And of course, there's always going to be a lot of wishful thinking about where we are in the present that maybe ignores some of what we got wrong.
Mark Pesce, I wish we could keep talking about it, but we're about to hit the news. Thank you so much for coming on.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for the Hack Podcast. I'll catch you tomorrow.